This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Plus, auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Quote now at progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm actor and comedian Griffin Newman.
And I'm film critic David Sims.
Together, we host Blank Check, a movie podcast where week by week we overanalyze directors' complete filmographies.
In each new series, we discuss filmmakers who experience early success and are issued a series of blank checks by Hollywood to make their own crazy passion projects.
Now, sometimes those checks clear and sometimes they bounce, baby.
We're joined each week by incredible guests, including actors, writers, and directors. So you can follow Blank Check with Griffin and David on Spotify for new episodes every Sunday.
The year is 2003, and that can mean only one thing. It's Suntory time. The movie? Lost in Translation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Unspooled. Ooh, we have a new karaoke singer entering the chat. That is Rico Galliano, who is going to be guesting with us today. Since Paul is still out of town, I am, as ever, Amy Nicholson, film critic. We will miss Paul. Paul will be back next week. But in the meantime, welcome Rico Galliano from the Movie Podcast. Rico, hi.
Hi. I am so honored and happy to be here. I love the show. And I'm a little cowed to be filling the shoes of Mr. Scheer, only one of the fastest thinking, funniest hosts ever. But I'm hoping some mild wit and my movie nerddom will carry the day.
Movie is a podcast where you, Rico, get to be a podcast cinematic explorer. You know, it's almost like an audio documentary, doing really deep dives into very specific niches of film culture. Season one, which I adored, was all about like looking at the number one cult movie from different countries and trying to figure out why that country, why that film.
Yep. Why that moment.
Why that moment. Season two was all about the rise of cult movies, which I got to hang out a little bit and talk about Harold and Maude with you for that one, which was so fun.
It was actually kind of, it was theaters, like movie theaters that sort of influenced cinema culture and the stories of these theaters. And you got to talk about, yeah, which one was it that you were on? You were on two. I was the Cinémathèque Française that started the French New Wave.
Oh, yeah. I think we also talked about El Topo.
Yes, you talked about Alejandro Jodorowsky's El Topo, which was basically made huge by a theater in New York City called the Elgin Theater, who came up with the great idea of programming it at midnight, which is not something that had been done before, and basically created the midnight movie with that film. So we got to talk to Alejandro Jodorowsky and you.
But Rico, we're about to do a movie that is all about exploration. And before we do that, I want you to tell us what MUBI has been exploring now in its new seasons.
Oh, the latest season just wrapped up. It has been about fashion in film. And in every movie, in every episode, we have talked about a movie that sort of captured a fashion look of the era. And then we dive into what that look meant to the people that created the look, what it meant to the filmmakers when they kind of put it on screen, and then what it meant to audiences after they saw it. A lot of times it's movies that sort of took a fashion style and then like exploded it around the world. And I thought that that would be a very shallow by its nature kind of season. But when I started looking into it, you realize that when you start talking about fashion and film, you end up talking a lot about like people's identities. So we did like the first episode was about Breathless, the Godard film from 1960. And that movie like sort of shatters gender norms and is all a lot about like the fashion style that Gene Seberg wore, just like really revolutionized fashion in a lot of ways. It's still a touchstone for fashion. And then we did Do the Right Thing and the kind of street style Do the Right Thing and how it kind of represents the politics that's in that movie. And also kind of, you know, it was a lot of people's first look at sort of the Afrocentric hip hop look of the era, and on and on and on. And I think the reason why you may have had me on this particular episode is that we also did an entire kind of like episode about the career of Sofia Coppola as reflected through the costumes and fashions in her movies, because she is so intensely identified with them. And we actually talked to Sofia Coppola for that episode. And we also talked to her about Priscilla, her latest.
Well, then you are perfect to be my Sofia Coppola whisperer for a film that is all about listening, interpreting, understanding, and maybe not understanding a movie that ends with the most famous whisper in movie history.
Where that's true.
We have no idea what Scarlett Johansson is saying to Bill Murray, yeah, and vice versa.
It's like the light coming out of the suitcase in Pulp Fiction. What is it? What does it mean? We'll never know.
We'll never know. But you know what we can do?
What?
We can ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba, unspool it. The year is 2003, and Sofia Coppola has finally pinpointed what she wants to do with her life. 13 years earlier, Sofia was publicly trashed when she agreed last minute to step into Winona Ryder's part in The Godfather Part 3. She did her dad a solid, and for that, she was roundly, roundly mocked. I mean, even if you have not seen The Godfather Part 3, you have probably heard that Sofia Coppola is in it and that she was god-awful. Now, national laughingstock is a very tough spot to be in when you are just 18 years old, but luckily, Sofia did not really want to act. But she didn't really know what else she wanted to do. She became a painter, she became a photographer. She hosted a very, very, very 90s TV show on Comedy Central. She answered phones for Chanel. She became a perfume muse. She started her own clothing line. She was busy, but she was a little bit lost in her identity.
Mm-hmm.
And then she got married to Spike Jonze. And then she directed her first movie, The Virgin Suicides. And then the conversation around her started to shift. That maybe the world's most famous, quote unquote, untalented daughter really did have something worth contributing to the world of art. And then she made Lost in Translation, which sealed the deal and gave her a reputation not as a lousy actress, but as a brilliant director of actors, a filmmaker with a rare mix of naturalism and precision. Lost in Translation is a story about cultural dislocation, starring a young woman who is a little like her, a girl married to a talented and successful guy who's trying to figure out her purpose while she is bored in Tokyo, waiting for her husband to get off work. The girl, Charlotte, is played by Scarlett Johansson, and the husband, John, is Giovanni Ribisi. But the central romance is between Charlotte and a fading Hollywood movie star named Bob Harris. That's Bill Murray, who is also staying at the Park Hyatt Hotel in Tokyo while he's slumming it shooting commercials for Suntory whiskey. This is 2003, but it's kind of 90s in that mentality that it is so embarrassing to sell out for something that you do not believe in. Charlotte and Bob slowly bond as they eat sushi, sing karaoke, get into fights over shabu shabu. This is not a movie about sex and maybe not even a movie about love, but it is about loneliness and connection, and also about making fun of terrible Hollywood actresses like Anna Faris, who's here as Kelly, this annoying blonde at the hotel who's doing a press tour that is basically just a summation of everything Sofia never, ever, ever wanted to be in the first place.
Yep.
Lost in Translation opened on September 12th, 2003. It was an independent shoot that only cost $4 million. Focus bought it later. And it made over $118 million. It won Best Original Screenplay at the Oscars, and it landed three other nominations for Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Director, making Sofia the first American woman ever nominated for the big, big, big directing award. The other two nominees, by the way, are the Italian director Lena Wertmuller and the Australian director Jane Campion, who had already lost for The Piano at that time, but, you know, she eventually won for The Power of the Dog. So, what was in the zeitgeist that September? I am not happy about what was number one on the charts at all this week. Even though the song, like the movie, does name check several members of the Rat Pack, and it is also about being glad that you and a special someone came to a place that you don't fully understand and that you're happy for reasons that you cannot fully explain. It is also a song that is proud about selling out. It shouts out the movie soundtrack that it is from twice in the first two verses. It is Nelly and Diddy and the song Shake Your Tail Feather.
You should know that I do not know that song.
Oh, you should know that you probably actually do. I see you cool as Bad Boys 2, the soundtrack. Let's go. Yeah. Come in, come in. Who your name is? Where you from? Turn around. You don't know that song. There's no way you don't know that song.
No, I've definitely heard it. For some reason, the title escaped me, but I do think it's hilarious that they call out the title and it's a sequel. How often has that happened?
Exactly. I mean, I like that we are talking about bad movie music for a movie that is known for its very good movie music.
Oh, man. I'm a vinyl head, so we can get into this if you want to spend the next hour.
You are a vinyl head. You're a guy who has all of your albums arranged in alphabetical order and a binder telling people where they are in your collection.
I don't have a binder, just a spreadsheet, which I think is even geekier. Only I have access to it. I have multiple versions of this soundtrack, including a bootleg. Don't tell anyone.
Whoa.
But the original release on vinyl apparently didn't sound that great. So like 15 years or whatever later, it was re-released on vinyl and people went crazy for it. And for a while, that version was worth like $150. It's been re-released, so you can get it cheaper now. But yeah, it's that good a soundtrack. It's one of the best of the decade, I think. By the way, when I started collecting vinyl, I honestly thought to myself when I'd pick up a piece of vinyl, this is long before I was married or had any prospect of having a child, I was like, you know, I want this one on vinyl, not CD or something, or just, you know, streaming, because this is something I want my kid to have. And now I have this enormous vinyl collection and I realized this is not a gift to my kid. This is a horrible burden of like thousands of records, most of which he's never going to give one damn about, and he's going to have to figure out how to sell them.
Well, you never know. He could become a DJ like a lot of kids do in their 20s and scratch up all your records, and then they won't be worth anything. But Sofia Coppola, we're talking about a person who grew up in a life a lot like in Lost in Translation, you know, except sometimes you look at this movie not just through the lens of her being Scarlett Johansson, but through her being the lens of like the kid left behind in America while her dad is off doing things like shooting commercials for whiskey, which is a true thing that happened to her and her dad. Her dad in the 80s went to Japan and shot Suntory commercials it was him and Akira Kurosawa.
What?
And they're like, yeah.
I did not know that. I mean, I knew that she spent a lot of her childhood actually going around the world with her family. They were like traveling movie nomads, which also leads her to do these movies about kind of insular worlds where you're kind of an outsider, or like weird, unusual worlds where you're like suddenly finding yourself an outsider. But I didn't realize that. No. Was it Suntory that he shot?
It was actually Suntory. I tried to pull a clip of it, but he doesn't actually say anything. It's like a Japanese announcer talking over him as he is, you know, drinking Suntory whiskey with Akira Kurosawa, which just sounds like the coolest thing on the planet.
Oh my God.
But I did pull some Celebrity Suntory commercials because, of course, that's this kind of show. Most of the ones that Suntory makes, the American actor does not talk at all, but there's a couple exceptions. One of them is Sammy Davis, who did one. And I thought that was a great, like, Rat Pack Sammy Davis Suntory connection. He really only gets one line, but here it is.
Suntory.
I'm a huge fan of that, but you know why I know that ad?
Which why?
You thought you were going to surprise me with that ad.
I did.
But I know that ad because a lot of years ago, I can't remember exactly when, Father John Misty, and I don't even know why he did this, but he did a parody of that exact ad.
What?
And suddenly this thing like shows up in my feed and it was like, what the hell is this guy doing? Like, what does this have to do with anything? And it led me back to the Sammy Davis Jr. commercial, which he's parodying. I mean, it's a heck of a thing to parody. It's like a pretty deep cut to parody.
That is the deepest cut. The only thing I can do is, and I'm putting this in because of the episode we did last week, which is on Moonstruck, Coppola, The Connection. Going to get into that in a second. But in the 90s, Nicolas Cage went to Japan to do a series of Japanese commercials himself. So her cousin was in Japan doing Japanese commercials, but his were for pachinko. And they're musical. There's many, 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 but this one is my favorite.
Oh, hi. I'm Nicolas Cage, and this is a song for you.
My favorite things. Blue jeans, see a red-haired girl. Slow-burning candle, cup of tea and a good book, the dance of the reindeer, and also pachinko. Yeah, pachinko, pachinko was.
Wow. What, you know, What a great lucky bastard he is. Somebody probably paid a bazillion dollars for him. They probably flew him to Tokyo, even though that's an interior. They could have shot it anywhere. But I just feel like he was probably flown to Tokyo and they just were like, go wild, buddy. Here's some whiskey, P.S.
Here's the thing about Sofia Coppola. When people tell most young filmmakers, write what you know, a lot of times you get kind of boring stuff. But honestly, with Sofia Coppola, when people say write what you know, she can be like, oh yeah, both my dad and my cousin went to Japan to shoot ridiculous commercials. If I write what I know, it's going to be kind of an interesting story.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating. It is interesting because she does, I think a little bit even today, there's a little bit of, well, is she a Nepo baby? But it's, I mean, now she's got such a body of work, it's really hard to deny how fantastic she is. But it's also, from the very beginning, it's like this very unique point of view. It is not your standard kind of Hollywood kid point of view. She wasn't even raised in Hollywood. She's raised outside of, you know, up in the wine country of Northern California, and then spends half of her life like trotting around the globe. She's got like a lot going on. She's seen a lot.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think like, it's strange. I always find people seeming to be a little bit protective / negative towards her, right?
You know, 'cause, one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, the easy slam on her is just that she was privileged, you know, to grow up in this business, to grow up with that last name. The credit Nicolas Cage gets for changing his last name to be Cage and not Coppola, you know, all of that. And yet, I think when you look at that body of work, you can see what unites it is a really, I would say, strong filmmaker point of view. I mean, she does these movies that are about young women trapped in gilded cages, you know?
Yeah.
And it's always what her movies are about, you know, starting with like The Virgin Suicides, about like girls stuck in their Detroit house. Here's a girl stuck in the Park Hyatt. You know, Marie Antoinette is a girl stuck in Versailles. Somewhere, a movie I love is Chateau Marmont. You know, then mm-hmm. you've got Beguiled, Southern Plantation. You've got Priscilla in Graceland.
For sure.
And all of those movies, I think, are really, really, really eclectic in their own way. But they're truthful to her experience, which I think is the experience she knows. And what
yeah.
I like that experience. And I find like I can find, even though I grew up trapped in a suburb, I feel like I can find little bits of myself in them.
I think a lot of people can. It does, even though it's really specific and really, you could argue, privileged point of view, it resonates, I think, across class and a lot of different kinds of boundaries. And it's also interesting because, like, when that started out, it's like it's hard to remember how unusual it was, A, to have a female point of view at all in a film that would get any kind of real distribution and attention. And also that, like, even before she made movies, you mentioned she was taking photographs, and her teacher was like, you have a unique point of view. And even she will admit that today that unique point of view is like what you would see every day on Instagram. And it is basically, she was like taking cues from this, I think a Japanese photographer actually called Hiromix. But it was like women taking, like young women taking pictures of their environment, like taking pictures of their feet hanging off the edge of the bed, or like of the bedroom, or of just like their daily lives. But that was crazy back then, like young women expressing themselves and showing their lives. That's not, who does that? When has that ever happened before? So it's like she really broke, I think, a lot of ground. I think there's a reason why she's so huge still to this day on Instagram, is that she's like almost like unintentionally, by the way, because she's not a big social media person, but like the godmother of that kind of thing.
No, that's true. And that's such a specific thing that even Scarlett Johansson's character makes fun of herself for doing in here. Like, oh, I tried being a girl photographer, taking pictures of my feet.
That's right. She literally says taking pictures of her feet.
Yeah.
When I interviewed Sofia Coppola, she literally used that term. I didn't even make that connection. Like, I wonder if she like still is using that line. Like, she wrote the line then and doesn't even remember.
I wonder, but it also feels like such a more innocent time to be pre-internet. In that way, like I used to take pictures of my feet because I like getting my toenails done, and then they all wound up on WikiFeet. So now I cannot take pictures of my feet, you know, because this movie exists in a world that is like so specifically pre-cell phone, where if cell phones existed, if more communication existed outside of Tokyo with your world, it would be a completely different film. You'd just be watching Scarlett Johansson sitting in her bedroom flipping through social media, which now I want to defend because you're right, like. Instagram, I think, is a space of social media and creativity. Like, I get into this fight a lot with my friends where, like, TikTok, fuck TikTok, ban TikTok, which I can see, I guess, the point of, I don't know, spyware. I have no idea. I actually don't know how much of that is like true or overblown. But the idea of people figuring out how to create their own art and be artists using this as like their gateway, as like their film school.
Yeah. I mean, I do actually think Instagram of all of those, I'm going to make like a horrible judgment call here that is like easily argued against. But I do feel like of a lot of the platforms, Instagram is the one that is arguably you can get kind of the most artistic with aesthetically anyway. It's like even TikTok, the aesthetic, the general aesthetic of TikTok is kind of an explosion, but you can like do really subtle things on Instagram and get some attention for it still, I think.
Although lately a thing has been happening in film culture that has gotten me so excited, where finally the generation of people who were raised up making their own shorts on YouTube are now making their actual features, which is a thing I've just been like so looking forward to happening. And so now this generation is making movies and it makes me so excited.
Yeah, I am too. I wonder what Sofia Coppola makes of this kind of thing, because I think she'd be encouraging of it on one hand, and on the other hand, she does seem like kind of purposefully not engaged in it. Like she made the Bling Ring because it was like her first exposure to, she had just come back from Paris, living in Paris for a while, and had just had a kid. Maybe she came back to have the kid. I can't remember exactly the timeline, but in Paris, kind of celebrity culture wasn't quite as prevalent. And I think Facebook was just kind of coming into being. There was this like group of kids that were kind of spreading it, the gospel of celebrity culture or something. And she was really upset by it. And maybe not upset by it is the wrong word, but kind of like, what the hell is this? Like, this is not good for the world. And thought it was a flash in the pan in a way. But she made the Bling Ring in a way was kind of like, this is where this leads us to this real life situation where young kids are like using the internet to go invade celebrities' homes and steal their stuff. So I have a feeling like on one level, she's like not the biggest social media fan, but on the other hand, I think she would encourage that kind of thing, the creative aspect of it.
Oh, that's true. But yeah, like I think if Charlotte was in Japan today, Charlotte would probably be taking pictures of sushi and like loosely trying out being an influencer. But because that doesn't exist when this movie is set, she's trying to figure out where her place would be in known jobs that exist. Like, is she going to be a writer? Is she going to be a photographer? It's concrete stuff. It's not like you are your own brand, which is now the new career path, is just being your own brand, because there are no homes for anybody anymore inside of like an institutional job.
Yeah, that's interesting. And she complains about this to Bill Murray. As you said, she's like, yeah, I try to take pictures, but you know, I'm not really interested. You know, it's just pictures of my feet and stuff. But if she had social media, she might put that stuff out there and find that there are a ton of people that were willing to look at her feet.
There are probably a ton of people who are willing to look at her feet.
By the way, I did some research into, I was actually looking up something else in the movie. I can't remember, maybe the translation or something, and weirdly came upon an archived Ars Technica chat room, you know, like a forum where people were talking about this movie ecstatically. It had just come out. It was like, it's from February 2004, I think. The movie had come out in September of the previous year, so it was just a few months after it came out. And there were all these people talking about it. And what's fascinating is to be reminded that Scarlett Johansson was not a superstar before this movie came out. But this movie, I think this and also Girl with the Pearl Earring later the same year, puts her on the map.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's almost a reverse Tori Spelling, her casting in this. Because we're used to seeing older people cast as teenagers. And this is a movie where she's, what, 17 when she gets cast in it, 17. Playing 25. You know, and the idea of finding an actress who can go up 8 years, that's like a third of her life, I find really, really shows something distinctive, both in like Scarlett Johansson as like an actress who could project depth and wisdom and experience while also having been a kid who, you know, was on movie set since what, she was like 11, 12.
Yeah. She's so good in this movie too. It actually, you just reminded me of something. So she was 17 when she did this, and it's like Coppola has said that making Priscilla was difficult because of the age difference between, at first it was difficult, like staging like their kiss, their first kiss, because the age difference in the characters is huge. But she was okay with it. She felt better because the actress that she had cast was much older. She's like in her 20s. But here's a movie where there's a huge age difference for real between characters. But clearly that staging their kind of tenuous romance wasn't so tough for her. And I think that says something about the romances in those two movies and how different they are. This is so much, like you were saying at the beginning, this is not so much, it's kind of a romance, but it's not quite a romance. You can kind of get away with the fact that they've got this huge age difference because there's something else going on here.
That's true. And I think it says something a lot about a change in audience and their knee-jerk reactions. Because when she gives interviews about this now, Sofia Coppola, you find her saying, I could not make this movie today, like at least once or twice in an interview.
Really?
Usually about the fact that she opens up the movie with that, you know, famous shot of Scarlett Johansson's lovely young 17-year-old butt in see-through underwear.
Yes.
Which I swear there is so much online, like actual scholarly research about that shot of the butt. Yep. Everybody has a really polarizing, strong opinion on it. You know, is it like a, like implicating us in the male gaze, or is it showing the intimacy of a young woman alone and she feels really comfortable? Like you can spin it in 900 different ways. And I think Sofia Coppola's stance on it is just like, I thought it looked pretty. It reminded me of this painting. Scarlett was a little bit nervous about it. I wore the pants for her so she felt comfortable. And Scarlett was like, I would have never done this for Robert Redford, you know, a movie. She had just done a Robert Redford movie. Oh, yeah. But she's like, working with a female director, I felt comfortable. So it was almost shown as like an example of how female directors can make a set more comfortable. But now I think people would just be weird.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, like, there's a way. What's interesting though about it is I remember seeing it when it came out in the theaters, and that first shot, it was like, because I had no idea what I was in for. I can't even remember. I think somebody brought me to see it because they were like, I've heard this is good. And I was like, oh, is this going to be a sex comedy or something like that? Which it clearly is not. Or is this going to be an erotic film? Which it also isn't. And it's kind of amazing how I totally forgot that that is the opening shot of the movie until I got it on. I love the movie and I got it on DVD when it came out like a year later or something. It was like, oh yeah. And it's surprising because it's like an arresting way to start a movie. And it's like really, it's a heavy statement. Like it doesn't surprise me. And I don't think Sofia Coppola would be or should be surprised that people talk about it a lot because it's a crazy way to open a movie that is not about eroticism or sex. It's like, what are you doing, man?
Do you think that in this movie, she is testing us to see how, to see if we think it is a movie about sex? To see, like, if we think there's going to be a point where we're wondering if they're going to or nervous if they're going to.
Maybe. I think it has more to do with, like, she does this a lot in her movie. Like, she does it in Priscilla. The opening shot is also of a, like, disembodied part of a woman. It's her feet, her painted toenails on a shag carpet. And then, like, her painting her eyes. It's all close-ups of, like, that kind of thing. And I think it's more like things that get it. It's like you're getting pieces of somebody and then you're learning the whole person. So I don't know if it's teasing us that sex is going to be coming. I think maybe she should have thought of that. You could argue that maybe it's like, that's maybe the first thing you should have thought of. But she's a super aesthetic person. And like you said, she's like basing it on this painter that I had not heard of until I like researched this John Cassara. Who does this, by the way. That's like pretty much what he paints is like women in various, like in their underwear. And kind of disembodied, but like that she's kind of take, it's like pieces of a woman and then we're going to fill it in. Like there's more to this character. You could argue that it's a feminist kind of thing where it's like, we're more than the sum of our body parts or something maybe.
It's true. I think that is true. And I think she's also really interested in, I guess, putting some value on the fact that like people do figure out how they want to present themselves when they go out into the world. You know, like when here with Scarlett Johansson early on is kind of bored and she's in her room and she's putting on lipstick and she's dressing up the bedroom with the cherry blossoms. It made me think of like a new social media thing, which is like the stay-at-home girlfriend. People being like, I'm a stay-at-home girlfriend. Although I guess here she is technically a stay-at-home wife in this thing. Like, but how to live an aesthetic life where maybe you're wondering if that's what your value is, but it's not just demeaning. Because I think there's a lot of shots in movies of like people putting on lipstick and you're just like, oh, how ghastly, or look at that color. It's too bright and shiny, or look at that woman. She's vain or superficial, or there's judgments on it. I think women making themselves look beautiful in front of a camera sometimes. And here I think it just feels like sweet. acceptance. It's neutral. She's trying something.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like, this is how it is. This is a woman's life. Like, sometimes they're wearing those panties.
Yeah.
And we're not going to get any more into it than that. That's, and by the way, she, like, very specifically is not dressed in very, like, super stylish clothing or anything. It's very, it's kind of chic. It's, like, simple. But it's nothing fancy, which has been pointed out as, by the way, how Sofia Coppola dresses. Even though she's kind of this fashion maven and like does stuff for fashion houses, she herself dresses like she's extremely dressed down in a lot of ways. And so does Scarlett Johansson. So she's not like a show off or anything, but it's like that doesn't mean that she's not feminine. You know, maybe that's kind of the deal. It's a very simple pair of underwear, too. It's not lacy or frilly or anything.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, what I always think about it, Sofia Coppola style, is that it's kind of classic and effortless. Yep. It almost draws attention in a way, if anything, to how effortless it is that she's like, yes, I look beautiful in a boat neck sweater and jeans. Like, isn't that nice? I'm very glad that I look good in this.
It's in Priscilla. You could argue that she actually, it's fascinating in Priscilla, the arc of the costuming in that movie that it takes is exactly that. It's like she goes from, she's like a humble girl in the 1950s living on a, you know, barracks in Germany, and she's wearing like very simple clothing, and then Elvis whisks her away and basically tells her, here's what you're going to wear, and she's like totally into it, more or less into it. And throughout the movie, as she has less and less control over her life, the thing that she does have some control over is wearing like more and more crazy versions of Elvis's like vision of her, while Elvis is also getting more and more 70s'd out. But then when they cut to the 70s and she's kind of over it and she's getting ready to leave, she pairs all of it back. She's like not wearing, she's wearing pants. She's wearing just a simple shirt. And when she leaves him, she's wearing like a blazer and a shirt and pants. And that's it. And it's like the opposite of what you're used to seeing when somebody liberates themselves. It's like Sandy in Grease puts on the leather jacket and like does her hair up and like curls stud. And she's like smoking and stuff. And this is like the opposite. While Elvis has got like the sky high collar and like a Vegas outfit with like a cane with a skull on it. She's like wearing pants and a dress shirt or something.
Which has its own kind of power move, right? Like, I don't need that to be the version of me that I want to be out in the world.
Right.
But then also, I think Sofia Coppola has some fun in this movie taking her outfits and making them look a little bit dumpy on her. You know, there's that one shot where, like, she's in the hotel with her husband and they run into Anna Faris, who I'm definitely going to be playing some Anna Faris clips because, my God, she's so funny in this movie. But Anna Faris is wearing, you know, like, standard 2003 actress clothes. You know, like, kind of low slung jeans, like, bright colored shirt, a little casual, but, like, vivid. And Scarlett Johansson is dressed, honestly, in one of my kind of dream outfits, you know, button-up blouse, sweater vest. I love a good sweater vest.
Yep.
And there's shots of her looking, you know, kind of like a frumpy child compared to her. And there's, she's really building like a visual contrast between these two women.
But listen, let's all go out for a drink sometime.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
No, call me, okay?
Yeah, okay.
All right, listen,
okay.
I'm under Evelyn Waugh.
Oh,
okay.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, arigato.
Yeah, yeah. Ah! Mushy, mushy.
Evelyn Waugh.
What?
Evelyn Waugh was a man.
Oh, come on. She's nice. What? Not, you know, not everybody went to Yale.
The way she says arigato, this is just like the greatest comic performance from her.
It's true. This movie, as low-key as it is, and as much as she finds all of these worlds like alluring and finds the charm in all of them, there is like, there's some judgment going on, definitely. There's not just, there's also, in addition to the Anna Faris character, there's just one little moment with a kid when they're all eating at the bar, and there's a guy kind of trying to hit on her, trying to convince her that he is doing this fantastic music. And he's like, yeah, it's like I just evolved the beat, you know, kind of like that. He's wearing like a puffy jacket and he's like, you know what I'm saying? And her character is like, no. You could imagine that she feels alienated back home as much as she does in Tokyo.
That's true. Yeah, she doesn't really seem to have close friends anywhere, honestly. Like when she calls her friend back home to say, you know, I went to this temple, I didn't feel anything. You can hear in the clip, you know, just how checked out her friend is. Like, not really listening.
Hello?
Lauren?
Charlotte, hey.
Hey.
Oh my God, how's Tokyo?
It's great here. It's really great. I don't know, I went to this shrine today. Mm-hmm. And there were these monks and they were chanting. And I didn't feel anything, you know? And I don't know. I even tried Ikebana, and John is using these hair products. I don't know who I married.
Oh, can you wait a second? Just hold on. I'll be right back.
Okay, sure.
Sorry. What were you saying?
Nothing. It's okay. I'll call you later, okay?
Okay, have the best time, you know? Just call me when you get back, okay? Bye.
Bye.
Love you.
Oh, that is a heartbreaking scene. That is one of my favorite scenes in that movie. Because I know you and I are both like travelers. You get to do it more now because I have a kid, unfortunately. In that regard, unfortunately. And we've all been there. Like, as much as you love to travel, that moment of just being like, I really am not happy here right now. I'm really, really lonely and I don't know this place. And I really would just like to be able to walk out on the street and speak the same language and know where to go and stuff. And she is totally feeling that. And you're right. Her friend, that's a really good point because I've never understood. It's like, why does the friend get it? She's like crying on the phone. The friend doesn't get it. But you're right. Maybe she's not really that good a friend. She's just reaching out to the only person she's got, whoever that is.
Yeah, the way her friend just goes, have the best time. Like, she's not even listening to a word she's saying. It's almost... And I can imagine that feeling of like, oh, that bitch from college is in Japan and she's not even having fun, or, you know, or even just like not even thinking that it's possible she could be not having fun in Tokyo. But these are two scenes that we're talking about that are about Scarlett Johansson not being able to communicate with people who are speaking English to her. You know, even in English, she is not really able to connect with people.
Yeah, she's totally alien. Like, she really doesn't know. She says, I'm stuck. And it really, like, you get this real feeling that, like, it's a portrait of somebody who's really at that point where they're like, I remember there was a song, I can't even remember the name of the band, but it came out sometime in the 90s or the early 2000s, and it was called I Hate My Friends. And it was just that. It was like it was a punk song. It was like, I hate my friends. It was a girl group, actually. So that makes sense in this context. But, like, I remember that where you're, like, so tight with your friend group that it becomes incestuous, and you're actually like, I'm sick of all these people. Like, God, I can't break away from them because I don't know anybody else. Like, everybody I'm going to meet is going to be through these people, and I'm over it. Like, I wonder if that's the moment that she's writing this in. But she's also writing it at a time, well, this is interesting to think about. She's writing it at a time when her marriage to Spike Jones is dissolving. So maybe she was, it's kind of like she had a world through him that she's kind of like not really that into. Who knows? I mean, like, I'm putting a lot onto Sofia Coppola right now.
But that is true. I mean, this movie comes out in September and they file for divorce in December that year. So you know it's coming when you're filing for divorce in December. That you're right, because there are these periods in your life where you have that moment of like, who are these people I've surrounded myself with? It's like when you graduate high school, you get one. When you graduate college, you get one. I think you kind of get one maybe in like your late 20s, early 30s when you realize like, am I still friends with all these like first friends I made in the town I moved?
Yeah. You know?
And maybe they come up later. I mean, I assume like from the books I read, when you go through like your first divorce, your second divorce, your third divorce, your fourth divorce, everybody's just reinventing themselves all the time. I'm extrapolating from all the novels about bored people in colleges divorcing all the time. But some people make the transition, but you're transitioning.
Yeah, for sure. And definitely, like, it's like growing older is a weird accumulating of and then paring away of friends at different moments and for different reasons, sometimes just like for practical reasons. There was just an article in the New York Times from, oh man, I'm going to blow it. Who was it? Frank Bruni. He like fell out of touch with friends for no reason. He like still liked them. They used to contact each other multiple times a week. And then it's like they weren't working in the same office anymore, or they weren't, one of them moved slightly outside of the city, or like in New York, it's like they moved to Queens and he moved down to Brooklyn or something like that. And then it's just like it becomes harder, and suddenly this person that was like essential to your life is just gone. So I can totally imagine that this is where this person is, and the Tokyo experience is just like the most glaring representation of her place in the world. It's just a metaphor for being out of it, of humanity, and finding this dude who's similarly displaced.
When I was watching this movie, I was thinking about my experiences going to film festivals, because that's sort of my closest parallel to this. Because when you go to a film festival in a different country, you have some sort of structure, you have some sort of people to interact with. You have people who are often like being really kind, like taking care of you in certain ways. Like, hello, here's this, take this, come over here, meet us here at this time. But you also are completely dislocated from your time period. And yet you're bonding with these people who you know in the back of your head, you're only going to know for maybe a week or 10 days. And they're the only person on the planet who will understand what your life was like for this week or 10 days.
And I think that's what's interesting about everything that we're talking about is that you can feel the characters in this movie understanding that as it's happening, which I think is rare. I think maybe Bill Murray's character, I totally buy it. Her character is preternaturally able to sense, I think, that there's no real long-term future in this. This is what it is. It's just going to be these few days.
Yeah, but there's a phoniness to it that I think is fascinating. Like an admitted phoniness, right? Because one of their first conversations is when they're both bored at the hotel bar, which, by the way, is the real bar, and it's on the 52nd floor of the hotel, which was so much taller than I was picturing it being. I mean, I did see that there's a tour you could go on for $449 if you are going by yourself in the spirit of the movie. It's like an all-day Lost in Translation tour in Tokyo where first, for some reason, you meet like an Isomo robot, and then you eat ramen at a place where you're not allowed to talk because like the guide book, the website says that, you know, not being able to talk, quote, really adds the immersive of being alone. And then you wander the neighborhood, and then you go to the hotel, and then you go to the temple she goes to, and then you go to Shibuya, and then you go to the shabu shabu place for dinner, which I think is really funny because that's the place that famously kicked them out for going 10 minutes after the shoot time and was like, they turned off the lights, they unplugged their equipment. They're like, it's been 10 minutes after the time you said you'd be here. The locations manager quit because it brought shame upon him for not obeying the rules. But now they're like, yes, there's a tour for $447. Come here and eat dinner. But no, to that idea of like the phoniness, you know, in that hotel room, their first encounter is basically like made up, talking about the prison break.
I'm trying to organize a prison break. I'm looking for like an accomplice. We'd have to first get out of this bar, then the hotel, then the city, and then the country. Are you in or are you out?
I'm in.
I mean, they're not going to have a prison break from this. They are not being serious. They both know that they are not being serious. And so the movie is about, can they even manage to get serious with each other? Or how can they get serious? Because they're kind of just playing around the whole time. Like, even at the end of the movie, when they run into each other, when the fire alarm goes off, they're still just playing around. This is like a made-up world they're living in.
Yeah.
I like watching this movie as, you know, a story of like two people who are sort of play acting the idea that they're going to be good friends forever. Just a little bit, just a little bit. But they're meaning it, but they're also play acting. I mean, she even has that one line at one point where she's like, let's never come back here again.
Yeah, it won't be as fun.
Because it won't be as good as this trip. You know, and it's just so, it won't be as fun.
It's true. I can't remember if this is in that scene. I don't think it is. It's in a different scene. And it's actually one of the most amazingly acted scenes in this movie, which is when they are finally talking late at night in the hotel. Let's say about 20 minutes before the end of the movie, he's like, he can't go to sleep. She can't get to sleep. And he sends a message to her to, are you still awake? He sends this typed message to her and she comes down and they watch actually, I think a very significant clip. They're watching on TV, the scene between Marcello Mastroianni and Anita Ekberg from La Dolce Vita, where they're hanging out in Rome at night. And first of all, it's a fascinating scene for them to be watching because the nature of that scene is that Marcello Mastroianni has become infatuated with her. She's about to get married. So therefore she's unavailable, just like both of them are in the movie. And they go through this nighttime city. And then they're waiting. There's about to be this great kiss. And then all of a sudden they look around and it's daylight. And it's like the magic is broken and they have to depart. That's the nature of the scene that they're watching. And it's almost like that's what's about to happen in their world. They've been like having this nighttime spectacular, but they both know that it has no hope for like real romance at the end. But they do end up talking in that scene about, it's the only time where he's like giving her almost fatherly advice. And she's like asking him about, you know, why he's stuck in the world. and they're like kind of sleepy, and maybe they could make out if they wanted to, or this could be like fatherly, you know, advice giving and young person bucking up the older guy thing. And they're kind of caught between these worlds. And it's like, they so nail it. They nail it. That scene is amazing. And I do think in that moment, they're being serious. Like they know that something real is passing between them in that moment. It's not just play acting.
It's true. And they're in that pose that made me think of that famous shot of John Lennon and Yoko Ono, you know, where one person is curled and the other person is straight. But in the John Lennon pose, they're intertwined. And here he's just touching her foot.
Yeah.
But it's still, I mean, this is a movie with so much intimacy in it. I was surprised to read later that Sofia Coppola actually had to stop shooting that day because Scarlett Johansson and Bill Murray were not getting along. And so she couldn't get that tone. They had to just rap and then try again to see if they could get, if she could get them both to relax around each other the next day.
It is crazy to me how I've heard, because, you know, they both love the movie and they're very respectful to each other. But like Scarlett Johansson has said, it was not an easy shoot for her. And it seems nuts to me because but she acknowledged that on screen they were able to turn it on. And that is just a testament to those two actors. If they were not really feeling it off screen, that's amazing to me. It must have, I mean, it says something about Coppola's talent too.
It's true, but you like hear it in the subtext, you know, when she talks about the film. I mean, this is her, when the movie came out, you know, she's on like a press tour talking about this movie and Girl with the Pearl Earring. And, you know, she sounds always very, very nice and polite about Bill.
When the cameras were rolling, everything just sort of came together. We didn't have to discuss. We didn't have to do so much rehearsal. It just kind of was spontaneous and easy. I don't know.
But then also, you know, she's young. Like, he's the one who's like the famous celebrity at the time. So really, what is she going to say? And I think now that she's on equal footing with him, she's allowed to at least just be say it was difficult, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't easy. I mean, because from the vibe I get about how he was on set, he was either like aloof and off in his own world, or just being very, very on, you know, being like public Bill, which is a completely different personality.
Mm-hmm. He's the huge star. Like we just said, she was like really young, not the huge mega star. And also like, it is like she was dressed like, so I spoke to the costume designer and she was like, we were dressing her like Sofia Coppola. Like, and Sofia never said anything. She never said anything to me, but I was pretty sure that we were dressing her like Sofia Coppola. And Scarlett Johansson, who's 17, she's like, what is this? This is not what a 17-year-old would wear in 2003. And you can see what the other young people in the Americans in the movie are wearing, and they're not what she's wearing. And you get the feeling that she's like, you know, she's kind of Sofia's kind of persona thrust into this movie. And it's one that is, but Bill gets to kind of be whatever he wants to make it. Where she's being kind of like made to be Sofia and she's maybe not. I don't know. But you can't see it on screen. She's so good at it.
Yeah, Sofia wrote this character to be her. Although sometimes she'll be like, no, not really, but yes, really. But no, not really, but yes, really. But then she wrote the Bob Harris character specifically for Bill Murray to just be Bill Murray. It had to be Bill Murray. And nobody else was even going to play the part but Bill Murray. And like when she would talk about the movie when it first came out, all of the stories are just about how impossible it even was to get Bill Murray to do the film, that she had to call his, you know, his like random hotline that only leaves voicemail messages and he never answered the phone. She had to have everybody in her life call up Bill Murray. Like at one point, she even tells the story about like trying to get Al Pacino to do it and the humiliation of calling up one famous actor just to try to get him to talk to you about another famous actor that you want instead. It's like calling up somebody for a date with somebody else.
Oh, man.
The low points was I called Al Pacino, who I know a little bit through my dad, but I got his number and I don't know him that well. And I said, because I heard he lived in the same town outside of New York that Bill Murray lived in. And I called and said, you know, hi, Al, I'm doing this movie. He's, oh, Sophie, how are you? You know, have you been? Whatever. And the worst thing, I said, well, I'm wondering if you know Bill Murray. And oh, my God. I was like, I can't believe I asked Al Pacino. And my dad's like, you can't ask an actor about, because I'm doing this script. And he was like, yeah, you know.
That's remarkable. Can you imagine Al Pacino in this role? That would
You're calling me and work. You don't want me?
Right? Isn't that, but also, what? Yeah. So she wouldn't, you don't think she would have done it at all without Bill Murray?
I mean, that's probably what she was always saying, you know, that she was like, she settled down for like a month and month and month long process of like trying to get him, which to me almost shows like a full rounded picture of her idea of fame, that she has enough privileged connections that she knows people who can at least talk to Bill, which makes it easier, but it's still not easy.
It's not perfect, especially at that moment.
Yeah. And that there's kind of just this like overlapping doing each other solids. By the way, we talked in our last episode about how when Nicolas Cage was in eighth grade, his parents sent him to live with the Coppolas in, you know, in Northern California, how he went from being an A student to an F student, didn't fit in, and built in all of this rage about being an outsider that kind of fueled his career. And he changed his name and was like, I'm doing this on my own. Sofia Coppola was there, but she was a baby. So it's not like she was implicit in the making him feel uncomfortable in the home thing. But even so, you get out and there's just like this small circle where like, you know, Spike Jones cast Nicolas Cage in Adaptation, and then she's suggesting her other cousin, Jason Schwartzman, to like Wes Anderson to do Rushmore. And then Wes is helping her get Bill for Lost, sort of. But when she credits the people who finally got Bill to do it, it's like 900 people had to help her get Bill Murray in this movie. And she still didn't know he was going to show up until he just showed up, because he wouldn't even tell her the plane flight he was taking.
That is crazy to me. Like that, and that maybe says something about Bill Murray. I mean, like, I love him, and I've heard everything from great things about him to like, he's a very difficult person, but that is nuts. Like, what? I mean, because that, I remember seeing that in the extras for the movie where she's just like, I hope Bill shows up. And then it's kind of like, oh, he's coming. I can't believe Bill's coming. She's like so excited about it. I remember her saying something like, I get to dress him in things. I get to put him in clothes. Like, she's so excited about Bill Murray showing up. And then you got like, so here's this guy who's just like obviously got some amount feeling like a privilege that he can just kind of wing it over there whenever he feels like it. And then there's here 17-year-old Scarlett Johansson. It must not have been easy.
It must not have been easy. And there's something about his specific type of fame that I find fascinating, because, yeah, it's like, and I respect this element of it, where like he has likened being fame to, I think the example he used is that it's like being an amoeba. And then if you take an amoeba cell and you poke it 1,000 times, it will change and then reform again. And then the 1,000th time that you poke it, it'll just completely collapse.
Bill Murray said that?
Yeah, Bill Murray said that about fame. And he's like, that's kind of what it's like being famous, is that you have like 1,000 people poking you. And then on the like, the finally on the 1,000th time, that's when you explode. And so he, I think, has had to figure out how to control when he is Bill Murray. Right? Like, because there's certain people who, when you see them in public and they're famous, they will just give in and turn it on. I'd be like, hey, it's me. How you going? Taking the pictures, doing the thing. And I think he needs to protect himself where he won't do that, but then he will do it, but he'll only do it when he's in control, right? Because there's all of those famous stories about Bill Murray just like doing the Bill Murray thing. Bill Murray crashing a bachelor party and people are just filming him. And I think this character, you know, the way he moves through the world, you also get to see what I believe Sofia Coppola knows really well, that being famous is also its own way of being forever dislocated in time, where you fit in and you don't fit in, and you can kind of do anything you want, but also, you know, people are always staring at you and you never get to blend in. And he would use the Bill Murray-ness on set. Like if they needed more time in a location, a lot of time he could like walk up to the person and just give them a big hug and say, I'm Bill Murray. And then they'd be like, oh, fine, you can have whatever you want. You're Bill Murray. But it also means you never really are equal. You're never there. I want to always be gentle when people who are really in the public eye get exhausted with it, because I feel like I could never imagine what that feels like, right?
At all.
Yeah. And it seems like this movie, I think, also has that same mix of frustration and empathy. You know, because this movie does really make fun of the Anna Faris character. And I could go on for years about how I feel like we did not get enough comic Anna Faris roles, and how I secretly blame Chris Pratt, and I have no real cause to, except I just feel like that guy didn't want her to do more funny stoner comedies. And she was so good at them.
Really?
But there's little bits, even in that character, where, of course, Sophia's making fun of her, and people have said that she's making fun of, really, of Cameron Diaz, because Cameron had done Being John Malkovich with her husband. But there's that moment where she's also alone sitting up there at the press conference, getting hit with questions and just trying to do her best and absolutely rambling in a way that we've been at press conferences. Mm-hmm. We know that feeling of just like a person kind of panicky, filling up space and just trying to please.
What was it like working with Keanu Reeves?
He was always, you know, giving me ideas and, you know, really helpful. It made me feel really comfortable. So, and we both have two dogs and we both live in LA. So we have all these different things in common. So, you know, we both really like Mexican food and yoga and karate.
I think there's empathy in there, right? Because, I mean, yeah, Sophia has nice. Done that. Sophia has done that exact thing when she was in Japan for Virgin Suicides.
I mean, her movies are full of this stuff. It's like, this is why I think it's interesting when you really look at it and you see that she does have some moments. Her character, herself projected into the movie, has moments of judgment of other people. But yet the movie doesn't come off as being a movie about judging that world. And it certainly, and none of her movies really, I mean, I guess you could argue that some of them are, but a lot of the time she's at least sympathetic to the people in those worlds, like doing their best at navigating them. Like they're trying their best, particularly women, but all characters in this movie, you could argue that this movie is one of the movies that like most focuses on a male character too. Like Bill Murray begins and ends the film from his POV, even though it's a lot about Scarlett's character as well. But yeah, she never like, ultimately she's like, you know, you do what you do to get by. And sometimes you're annoying when you do it. And sometimes you're a jerk. I mean, Marie Antoinette is the perfect example of that. Like, how do you navigate this insane world? It's like, maybe you do go to excess. Maybe that's the only thing that you can do when you're basically trapped in a giant castle and your job is to like make a baby to be the next king. And maybe you go a little nuts and you maybe indulge yourself a little bit too much. I mean, if she can find sympathy for Marie Antoinette.
Wait, you know, what you're describing is really fascinating because I think you're exactly right. And I think that that is, I think you're articulating to me what I love about her films, which is that they have an element of forgiveness in them, even for the people she's making fun of, because she's also giving the Charlotte character a hard time for being judgmental, like with the Evelyn Waugh character, for being a snob. And to have these movies that she makes that are so, I would say, like, empathetic, you know, when she's a person who was treated really unempathetically as a teenager. Because I guess I really can't shake that feeling of her being publicly judged and mocked for pretty much all of her young adult years.
Yep. And she's gone on to make like these great, great films and to make them, you're right. I think maybe that is like the ultimate theme is just being empathetic to people who are, you know, in situations that sometimes they can't control. I'm trying to think. I mean, like even The Bling Ring, which is about literal, I mean, it's based on a true story. It is about literal thieves. And they didn't just thieve a little. I looked it up and it was surprised. Like they stole like $3 million of stuff. It's not, and it's like the worst thing from, they were already like more or less well off. And then they took all of this more stuff. And she still has like, for some of those characters, at least her main character, the boy in that movie, she has a lot of sympathy for him. It's just like this kid who, like her, by the way, never fit in at school. She was always like flicking around the world to all these different schools. She's talked a lot about how she like actually can't do math and can't help her kids with math because she was like at that point in her life, she was switching schools all the time and just couldn't keep up with it. And it's like, so she kind of sympathizes with this kid who's like a new kid in the like school that is specifically for kids in The Bling Ring who are, they call it the dropout school. The kids themselves call it the dropout school. And he's just trying to fit in and he gets in, falls in with the wrong crew. And like he is kind of, it's a way to like have some excitement in his life. So you're right. I mean, maybe sympathy and empathy is the hallmark of the Coppola film.
Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating because I feel like if you were going to guess what her personality would have been like as a filmmaker, because you cannot extract privilege from defining her, you'd be like, oh, she's probably really isolated. And the idea that her movies are actually the opposite of that, that they're like probing and curious, even if they are about girls locked in situations, she's curious about the people locked in them in a way that I find really complicated.
Yeah, in all different worlds, not just the worlds that she's like used to, lots of different crazy worlds. They're not always gilded necessarily either, but yeah, most of the time pretty gilded.
Oh, wait, but I do have to play a clip of the show that she did for Comedy Central in 1994, like 9 years before she made this movie.
Please
because
do.
That is like her in the last years, figuring out what she is. It is like the absolute polar opposite of what I would have guessed a Sofia Coppola show was. But oh my God, when I found these videos, I just could not stop watching them. This is from the premiere. It's called High Octane.
On a man-made battleground, it's the incredible Sofia and the mind-blowing Zoe. Lovey reporter Sean Martinson. And on this adrenaline-soaked episode of High Octane, 10,000-pound monster truck and the high-fashion runways of Paris. And director Gus Van Sant.
Wow. The smashing, I mean, in a way, it's kind of ahead of its time. The mashing of high and low culture there, monster trucks and Gus Van Sant, is like pretty rad. That's cool.
It is rad. And she's not messing around. Like, she really does, in that episode, take lessons in how to drive a monster truck. Oh, no. I mean, but it's so funny because, yeah, to put those ideas together, I think you do get a sense of her being a really individual filmmaker. Even though that movie is, that TV show is so much louder than any movie she's ever made in her entire life. I mean, talks about, like, when she made Virgin Suicides, how her dad, Francis Ford Coppola, came to set and he told her that when she said action, she had to say action louder. He was like, you have to say action more from your diaphragm. And she just thought to herself, like, you can go, that you don't need to be here. You know, like, she will say things how she wants to say them and she will get what she wants, and she will do her own thing the way she wants it to be. And if she wants to do a TV show for Comedy Central about how she learned to drive monster trucks, it will also be her kind of being like, yeah, and not having to play around and be like, yeah, monster trucks. She'll do it her vibe.
Yeah, she's never sort of like, what's the word? Like, tried to shed that vibe either. That's something that a lot of people have said about her too. I remember her saying something similar to what you were just saying about Francis Coppola, where he's like, you've got to be, in a way, you've got to be like the alpha male. And she's managed to make it work by being just like nice. It seems like she's like cool and nice.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's only two parts in this movie that don't quite feel like her. You know, like, one of them is when Bill Murray goes to the gym and he gets on that exercise like elliptical machine, and it just starts going too fast and he's going backwards and it's like speeding up and it's all chaotic. I mean, that just doesn't feel like her sense of humor.
Then
when I read later that was a Bill Murray improv, I was like, oh, I get that. And the only thing that surprises me is that she left it in.
Yeah, that is crazy. I didn't know it was an improv, but it totally makes sense because you're right.
Yeah, 100%. Because they're only allowed to film in the hotel at like 3 a.m. in public spaces. So I think it's just 3 a.m. and they're like really cracked out time wise and just goofing around. And he's like, this will be funny, but it's like something from a totally different movie. You know, it's a different Bill Murray movie.
You think she left it in for him?
Maybe just when they did it in a screening room, it got a big laugh and she was like, well, I guess I have to keep it in. And then the other one that I, you know, the one scene that I just really don't love is like when the prostitute shows up at the hotel and it's like awkward and loud and confusing. I mean, I can see that scene being, you know, the argument for how just confusing it is to be him in that moment. I didn't order a girl in my room. She's telling me to touch her. She's telling me not to touch her. She's screaming. It's a miserable scene. It's just a miserable, miserable, miserable scene.
It's very, everybody in it seems like not happy. And it's kind of like, it's dark in a certain way too. I also know people that like, and they've got a definite point that it's like verging on racist. I also think there's a scene where Scarlett Johansson's character is on the subway and she looks over a businessman's shoulder and he's reading a pornographic comic book, which is something that I've heard many women remark upon, that this is just a thing in otherwise like seemingly very low key, not low key, let's say it's like a very bustling city, but like in a city where that doesn't seem like that would happen, that is like completely okay. So I think she's maybe also trying, cause she loves Japan. She like, you know, got some of her first photography work in fashion magazines in Japan. She like did, I think she, maybe her clothing line was launched with.
Yeah. I think Japan is still the only place where you can buy it, where you can buy milk fed.
Yeah, milk fed. That's right. So like she loves Japan, but I think she also wanted to, I think there might have been some level of her that's like, I want to capture everything about this, the good and the bad, but it doesn't come off well, I feel like.
And yeah, she's talking about something that I think is kind of complicated, which is to talk about a movie about not fitting in. You have to make the moments where you aren't fit in pop somehow. She has to make sure we pick up on it, because in a way, I think it would be almost more conceited and hubristic to be like, yes, I went to this foreign country and I got along perfectly and I fit in and I really get it. I'm cool and suave. So you have to have these uncomfortable moments. I don't know. I think it's almost impossible to say for sure when something is like insulting versus when something is just true.
Exactly.
You know, Scarlett Johansson is walking on the street and she sees a gigantic dinosaur on an ad. And you know what? She's never going to know what that means. And the movie is never going to know what it means. And she's going to see the bride going through her rituals, walking through the park. And she's never going to have any idea what any of that means. We have no idea why the barkeeper starts shooting at Charlie Brown with whatever kind of laser gun that was and whether or not we should be scared and how dangerous any of that was. We just don't know. And there's kind of a letting go in this movie. Of like, sometimes you're just going to drift.
Yep. And sometimes it's horrible. At the beginning, both of them hate it. Bob can't wait. He's like, I got to get out of here. He calls his agent. His agent wants him to stay for an appearance on a talk show. And he's like, I don't want to do that. I got to get out of here. And then he meets Scarlett Johansson. And he's like, starts to have a good time. She takes him out with her friends and he starts to vibe with it. He's also not having a great time at home. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to stay. And by the end, they're like, we're having a great time. Like, we like this city. We're having a good time. It shows you the pluses and minuses, man.
Yeah. I mean, I know we've been talking forever and we should wrap up, but that is the part that I think really hit me in this rewatch was I found it inspirational that both Charlotte and Bob are not having the best time, but they still keep getting up every morning and going out and trying to do something and trying to find a way of making their city their own, which, you know, as a person who like post-pandemic is just so used to staying inside my own house, you know, this movie even made me inspired to leave my house more and have more serendipity because I get really controlled post-pandemic. I'm like, I know what I want to have for lunch and I'm not going to go out to some random restaurant. And that's ridiculous. The ability to get lost is a gift. You know, sometimes you just got to try. Sometimes you just got to plunge in. Sometimes you even just got to say, yes, I'll do Godfather Part 3 for my dad's sake. I'm saying that because we've been talking a lot about it in this episode. And Paul and I actually did an episode on it back in the day when the Godfather Coda, the death of Michael Corleone, the new edit of Godfather 3 came out.
Oh, wow.
It's a really fun episode. So I want to kick it to that if people have not heard it yet, because we also in this episode talked to Talia Shire. And it was really, really a great conversation about her, Connie, the female characters who exist inside of a Francis Ford Coppola film. And yeah, of course we talk about Sofia Coppola's performance. I mean, you gotta.
I will be listening. I did not catch that one. And I'm very fascinated. I saw that when it came out too. It was on Christmas Day. I went with my family because, you know, you might guess from my name, we're Italian. So you got to go see the new Godfather film. And we were all kind of what most people were at the time. You know, it's got its moments, but I'm not sure that worked. And my dad was just like, it's like opera. I loved it. Like, he got it. And that movie has been somewhat reassessed, especially in the light of that edit. And it's, you know, it's not a bad movie. It's got its moments.
It's really not. I liked that edit. And now I feel obligated to ask you, because you just mentioned being Italian and opera, what do you think of our last week's episode? What do you think of the movie Moonstruck?
I love Moonstruck. It is also a weird movie. It's like a gigantic, huge hit Oscar winner, and people love it to death. But you can tell it's written by a playwright because it just follows the characters almost as much as any plot. It's like it loves its characters so much that like whatever idiosyncrasies they suddenly revealed to the playwright, he was like, okay, we'll go down that alleyway for a little while. And it works somehow. It's like this big mash of a film and a mess of a thing. It's got like high comedy and low comedy and like drama and weirdness and all this stuff in between. It's I will not be alone in saying that I love that movie, though. That's not a hot take, I don't think.
No, I'm actually really glad we did these two movies back to back. I mean, not just for the tangential Coppola clan connection, but they are both in their own ways movies about people who have a sudden, really intense bond. Mm. It's just in one movie they scream about it, and then the other movie they basically don't like to talk about their feelings at all.
And the other two like end up together. The first in Moonstruck. It's a little bit different. But they live in the same city. It's okay.
Well, Rico, thank you so much for coming on. Tell people again how they can listen to more of you.
Oh, my gosh. It's been an absolute joy. I've been wanting to be on this show forever. Thanks for giving me the shot. You can find, first of all, the show's name is MUBI Podcast, spelled like the wonderful cinephile streaming service MUBI, with which I created it and for whom I work. And you can hear us on all the major podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. And you can follow me on Threads or Instagram at Rico Galliano. That is RICOGAGLIANO.
It's such a good show, buddy. I really have been digging it. And you keep going to like awards and winning awards and being like, la-da-da.
We do get awards. We were just up for Best Entertainment Show at the AMBY Awards last week. We have won Best Arts or Entertainment Podcast in the National Arts and Entertainment Journalism Awards last 3 years, for those who follow those. Lots of Webby nominations, no wins yet. It's cool. It's exciting to hear that people dig it.
Well, and thank you again for keeping me company while Paul is gone. Paul will be back. And I think, as maybe kind of a kinky twist, since we have had Sofia Coppola's movie about her divorce, featuring a version of her played by Scarlett Johansson, I think it's only fair that when Paul comes back, we do Spike Jonze's version, his movie, Her, which also happens to have the voice of Scarlett Johansson in it. And is a movie I deeply, deeply, deeply love. Enrico, thank you again for being here. You can find Her anywhere. And let's say some thank you to the people who help us put this wonderful show together.
Thanks. This is hard. I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing.
Our show could not be done without our team, and a huge thank you goes to them each and every week. Produced and edited by Cody Fisher, and our associate producer, Jessica Cisneros. Our engineer is Casey Holford, and our MVP is Molly Reynolds. Our theme song is by Michael Cassidy, and our fan art is by Kim Troxell. Check it out all on social media, and you can find us on social media at Unspooled on Twitter and Instagram, and you can join in the conversation about all things Unspooled on the Paul Scheer Discord at discord.gg/Paul Scheer. There's an entire Unspooled section. T-shirts, mugs, stickers, and all Unspooled merch are available at tpublic.com/unspooled. And you can get a deck of Unspooled playing cards and more merch at podswag.com. That's right. And if you can't get enough Unspooled, you can listen to our archive for free anywhere you get your podcast. But remember to rate and review us. It does help. And finally, you can always check out the API list. That's right, the ever-growing list that we will eventually shoot into space at unspooled.com. And just a reminder, my book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, comes out May 21st. You can pre-order it now, and if you do, I'll be so thankful. See you next time. Bye for now.
Hi there, this is Mary Holland. You may know me from Happiest Season, or Veep, or The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window. Or you may know me as Janice Cramps. Huh? I want to wish Comedy Bang Bang a happy 15th anniversary. Wow, 15 years old. Comedy Bang Bang is about to get its driver's permit. I'm so excited for it. And I'm, you know, really grateful because Comedy Bang Bang has brought me so much joy as a listener and a performer. And I'm just very grateful for this community that we have in Comedy Bang Bang. You can hear me and a lot of other very funny people on Comedy Bang Bang wherever you get your podcasts. So what are you waiting for? Tune in.